From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The more that I see photographs of gravel gardens and the more that I learn about this gardening style, which besides its distinctive aesthetic appeal promises to be water-wise and weed-suppressing, the more I want to give it a try. So I was happy to get an early copy of The Gravel Garden, a book that's due out in June, and be treated to virtual walks through 20 such landscapes in a range of sizes and styles. The book's co-author, Jeff Epping, who has been making gravel gardens for clients since 2008 and converted his own Wisconsin front yard from lawn to gravel in 2017, is here to talk about what kinds of plants work in these resilient gardens and provide us with some design inspiration too. So more in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third generation bulb company offering top size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
My guest today is Jeff Epping, a longtime horticulturist and garden designer, who for 28 years was director of horticulture at Ulbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, Wisconsin. Jeff's upcoming book is called The Gravel Garden, Visionary, Drought-Defying Naturalistic Designs, written in collaboration with Teresa Woodard. It takes us around the country into the UK and Germany, too, to look at how various garden makers have interpreted the technique of gravel gardening, and I'm so glad to welcome him back to the program today. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me back.
All the way from Wisconsin?
Hey, all the way from Wisconsin, where one day it's 90 and the next day it's frost warnings.
Oh, you must live here. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, congratulations on the book. We'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And I've been enjoying it because it's, as I said in the introduction, it's been kind of like making me think, huh, maybe I could do that over here, because not all gravel gardens are created equal. There's a lot of possibilities. And, you know, we all hear lately about lawn alternatives and, you know, oh, put a meadow in your front yard and so forth. But you put a gravel garden in yours. So it can be an ecological solution too, even a lawn alternative, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I always say that a lawn space is probably the best place for a gravel garden because they do well in full sun, where the best lawns do as well. And we have so much lawn that there's always an opportunity for a gravel garden. And it can start out as small as you want. I mean, 3x3 or, you know, really, really big, like a 3-acre gravel garden, like, that we cover in the book at Epic System. So, the beauty of them is that they are so climate resilient. And in this day and age of this crazy climate change, and water being so precious and all of us needing to think about how we utilize that, now is the time, I think, for us to think about all different types of drought-tolerant gardens. And I do design meadows, as you mentioned, but I have never worked with, designed, maintained a garden that's been easier to maintain and more in tune with Mother Nature and what Mother Nature provides than gravel gardens. And that's what really has something I just started out thinking, oh, this is kind of cool, to like, wow, this is really something that we should be promoting. So.
So here we are.
Right. I wrote a book, which I never thought I'd do.
Right. And in the new book, you say, basically, gravel gardening is a technique in which deep-rooted, drought-tolerant perennials are planted in about a 6-inch layer of gravel that suppresses weeds and conserves water. So that's the very, the simplest description. About 4 years ago, when you and I collaborated on a New York Times garden column, and we also did a podcast together, We talked about sort of the how-to of making a gravel garden, and I'm going to link again with the transcript of this conversation to that because people can get some of the how-to inspiration. But I wanted to talk today about kind of what you were just hinting at. You know, there's such a diversity of possibilities, both in scale and in style. And it's not just that sort of, I don't know, I think at first I thought, oh, you must mean an alpine, you know, a garden of alpine plants or something, right? When you say gravel garden, but
Right,
that's
and I
not
think
it.
that's what people think of as a rock garden, an alpine garden, and, but it's not really that at all.
Right. And
So
to show us that it's not, you take us to these 20 gardens in the US and elsewhere, and we could even start just as a small with a small trough, couldn't we? A trough garden. I think there are trough gardens in the book.
yes, absolutely. We as small as a trough. So if you're, in an apartment or a condo or something, and you just want to give the concept a try, you could do something like that. Or we even converted a somewhat derelict, a very leaky, three-tiered fountain that the City of Madison Water Utility was looking to hopefully do something with. Otherwise, they were going to jackhammer it out. Which is a lot of work and a lot of energy. And so they called me and we created this magnificent, I think, gravel garden. It's in the book. You can be the judge, but it's only 18 inches deep. And when you put 5 inches of gravel, that doesn't give you a lot of soil. But I'll be honest with you, it's one of the finest gravel gardens I've worked with personally. And of course, in the book, we like you say, feature 20. And it's really cool to see what everybody's doing, and we don't all do it exactly the same way either, but the basic components are there, right? The gravel being typically several inches, if not even up almost a foot deep, like Sean Conway's garden in Rhode Island. So yeah, it's really a lot of fun. And like I say, once you get them established, it's work up front. Don't get me wrong, because you have to do a few different things and have that gravel brought in and create that. But once you do that, then you're on cruise control for the future.
So you just mentioned Sean Conway in Rhode Island, and so, you know, there's that stereotype gravel garden, sort of, we think it's synonymous maybe with, you know, alpine-ish looking or rock garden looking. But then there's someone like Sean Conway in Rhode Island, and, you know, in the book, and he incorporates formally clipped hornbeam. I don't know, they're almost like topiaries. They're like these barrel-shaped, clipped barrel-shaped topiary-ish sort of things on top of, you know, the trunk, up on the trunk, and, you know, elevated sort of floating and a clipped purple beech hedge. And, you know, so it's not just that other stereotype. So I thought maybe we could just talk about, you know, some of the, you know, extremes and examples. I mean, some are very romantic looking, not stark at all, not harsh at all. Don't you
That's
think?
right. Yeah, and Sean, Sean's garden, prior was a vegetable garden, and it was actually a set for the gardening show that he used to have. And when the show, ran its course and they were done, he said, "I just can't maintain this giant vegetable garden anymore." And he was inspired by the work of Lisa Roper at Chanticleer, who we featured in the book as well.
Wonderful,
And
wonderful gravel
oh,
garden.
it's amazing, right?
Yeah.
And he said, "I'm going to try this." So he just tried a little corner and was so amazed at the results that he took it to another level. And he has these beautiful clipped beech hedge and like you mentioned, the
The
nice
hornbeams,
horn
yeah.
beams, yeah, and very, very clean edging and such. So a lot of times people have you know this, but have a little bit of a hard time accepting these naturalistic style gardens. And so these cues for care, as they say, help people accept the wildness to the garden. And that is repeated in most of the gardens that we photograph for the book, which is pretty neat.
So to have some element that says this is a garden, someone is maintaining this, someone is has put their touches on it, so to speak. It's something like his clipped hedges and his sort of topiary-ish hornbeams and so forth, like that alert you to it's not just a wild space.
Exactly, exactly. And Kelly Norris created a beautiful garden in Ames, Iowa for Anna McCracken. And Anna wanted sort of an ode to the prairie. And so Kelly, being the incredible designer that he is, created such a garden, and mostly native perennial plants and very, very wild, sort of wild in nature, but again, used Taylor junipers. So our native Junipes virginiana, and Taylor, though, is very formal looking, central leader, very upright. Looks like it's clipped, but it really isn't. And he used those along with some artwork in the garden and such, and pulled it off beautifully. It's such a gorgeous garden. And Joan Nassauer is the professor of landscape architecture at the University of Michigan, who coined this term, cues for care, or messy ecosystems, orderly frame. So, like you say, a hedge around something, or even a nicely edged lawn around a more wild landscape, really helps people
It
explore.
really does. And it can be as simple as a very large vessel of some kind, like a very, very, very large, almost sculptural pot or something, on axis somewhere, that draws your eye. I mean, it sort of changes the whole thing from a wild space to, oh, someone's been here and thought this through.
Exactly. Exactly. And oftentimes, sculpture in the garden, like at Ryman Gardens in Ames as well, that we featured. They have some really nice sculptures in there. And it varies, but it shows that somebody is paying attention. Somebody is caring for that garden.
At Olbrich, where you worked for many years, the botanical gardens, there are four gravel gardens, I think. And one is like a 5,000 square foot entry garden, and one is like, at first when I looked at the picture in the book, it's like a long border along a path, and the path isn't, I don't even think, gravel, maybe like a mulchy kind of path or a dirt path. But a long, long, long border. It almost looks like, the scale of a border where you do the old style sort of bedding out. And I think it used to maybe have annuals in it or something.
Yeah,
That, each
exactly.
year and be changed over as a sort of display element. And now it's this long, long, long perennial border, but it's a gravel garden.
Yeah, and it's front and center. It's right there along, the main road that takes you by the garden. And you're right. When I first started at Olbrich, it was always annuals, and it was beautiful. But there's a lot of energy that goes into such a big border like that. And so we did two things. There was a big lawn panel of bluegrass turf, and we converted that to a prairie drop seed meadow, and mainly green, but then we added more color to it over time. And then we changed that big annual border into a gravel garden. And it really has been successful. And I really wanted to have it front and center so that people could see that there's other possibilities as they were driving by, other than lawn and more lawn, right? And so then we took it to the next level with the entrance garden, that's right there at the main entrance to the to Olbrich. And that again was a very sort of 70s landscape with daylilies and pachysandra and all sorts of the common things. And we blew it up and put in a big old gravel garden, and showed that this is what we're trying to do at Olbrich, trying to be more environmentally friendly. And so it was a great entrance to the rest of the garden.
So a couple of times you've mentioned kind of prairie plants, the palette of plants being kind of prairie oriented or whatever, and grasses and forbs, flowering perennials and so forth. And so again, it's not just all rock garden plants, quote unquote. There's a wide range of plants represented in the gardens in this book. And but prairie plants do well, and I guess that's because they are drought tolerant. And that little definition that I read from the book earlier on, that one of the the sort of characterizations is that It's, in which deep-rooted, drought-tolerant perennials are planted, right? We're looking for things that are tolerant of drought and root themselves in deeply, yes.
Yeah, because, again, we have that thick layer of gravel. And I experimented with all sorts of different plants when I first started doing this. And though there are a lot of drought-tolerant perennials, they don't necessarily have deep root systems. So, like
Yeah.
many of the alpine plants, they have wide-spreading root systems, or, they're just good at rooting in and maintaining with a shallow root system. And so I tried things like creeping sedums, which you think, oh, sedums, they're the most drought tolerant of any perennial. And all the creeping types faded away within 3 years because they couldn't get roots down deep enough.
Okay.
So we're looking, yeah, we're looking at plants that have a deeper root system. And yes, the prairie plants are the stars, and there's many, many of those that work perfectly, though there's wet prairies too, so those species don't. But things like calamint, the non-seeding calamint, calamint the nepeta, subspecies nepeta, or cultivar called Montrose White, super drought tolerant and just a great perennial for the gravel garden. Whereas, Margaret, I always think of nepeta or catmint as being, super drought tolerant, right?
Yes.
And so it is, but not in a gravel garden. It doesn't root deep enough. And
Okay.
so I learned soon after planting many of them that they just didn't last. So I made a lot of mistakes along the way, but I've also figured out what works and what doesn't. And the beauty with the book was we saw plants out of our zone because we traveled to the East Coast. We even went down to Texas to see the work of Jared Barnes, Dr. Jared. And so those plants, work extremely well, but not hardy enough for us in Wisconsin. So it's yeah, it's it was fun to see, and the palette is pretty vast, actually, of what you might be able to use, for
There
sure.
were bulbs in a number of pictures in the book. And so they can root in deep enough. I mean, they're planted under the ground. The bulb itself is placed
Right.
lower in, and then so then the roots can get down to the subsoil or whatever we call it beneath the gravel, I guess, because bulbs seem to show up in a number of places, or
Yeah,
they have a
we featured, we did a little. So in each of the chapters, we kind of feature something unique about that garden. And the garden we talked mostly about bulbs was chanticleer, because
yes.
Lisa Roper has been doing fantastic work with bulbs. And many of the bulbs that we use, in our gardens are actually native to rocky, mountainous areas like Turkey and such. And when we put them in our rich, organic-y soils, a lot of them don't last because it's too moist when they're dormant, and they get, botrytis and other diseases that, they rot off. But in the gravel garden, we're not watering to any degree after it's established or at all. And the bulbs love it because they're just sitting there baking in that soil below. I shouldn't say baking, they're not hot, but they're dry, and that's what they like.
Right.
And they
Yeah.
come back year after year. A lot of the species tulips are just absolutely gorgeous.
Well,
But daffodils work, and all the bulbs that we've tried and I've seen in the gardens that not only we photographed, but I've seen, because we photographed during the growing season mainly. So Lisa was kind enough to share photographs. She's an excellent photographer of
yes.
her garden in the spring. And
She has
so
alliums, I think, in some spots and lots of other
yeah,
things,
at
but
Allium, Chionodoxa work well. Like I say, all the different daffodils, tulips for me at home, not so good. Not because they're not well adapted; it's because the rabbits love them. So,
Oh, the
no,
bane of my existence.
you, me, and a number of other gardeners, I'm
Yeah.
sure. But anyway, they're amazing. And also, yeah, you mentioned alliums, and of course there's the perennial alliums like Summer Beauty and Millennium and that group, which do great in gravel gardens. But there's also the big, the ball shaped alliums that come up and then go dormant, like Purple Sensation. And Adam Glass at Swarthmore College has a fantastic display of Purple Sensation alliums in their roundabout, which is a fun application for a gravel garden.
Yeah, no, it was so that was interesting because again, it's not just the plants you might think. It's a wider palette. What about some of the, I think of herbs as being liking good drainage, so to speak, but maybe their roots aren't going to go deep enough, so probably they wouldn't be, a lot of
Well,
them wouldn't
something
be.
like lavender does well. Now for us it's a little touchy because we're f a little farther north, but there's a lot of new cultivars out there now that we're experimenting with. But again, they like it dry, and so they do well. I'm sure if I was warm enough, rosemary would do quite well. I use here I can use the ornamental oregano, like Herrenhausen, or I think it translates to manor house, origanum, is a great gravel garden plant. And so, yeah, there's quite a number of sort of Mediterranean herbs that can do quite well. It's again, it's more about the hardiness, I think.
I remember there's a story in the book about one gardener in Pennsylvania who at Meadowbrook Farm in Pennsylvania, I think his name is Glenn Ashton, the head gardener there, and he had to relocate some prickly pear cactus when a deer fence was going to be installed. But instead of just sort of say, "Oh, I got to get these out of here and move them for the construction, and I'm going to put them over here," it was like the impetus for making a gravel garden, and they became a feature. So that's another plant. So depending on where one lives, and I mean, but that's another plant that a group of plants, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And Glenn is he is just a hoot. I mean, he's the funniest guy, most passionate gardener. And yeah, he piled up all sorts of gravel to create good drainage. And he's actually growing choyas, which I've only seen, grow down in the southwestern part of the United States. And Glenn's grown them in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, he's like
And
making these micro, I don't know what you would call it, like these little habitats, these like microcosmic little habitats because of these
yeah,
piles of
absolutely.
gravel. Yeah, no, it's great.
And agaves, things that, I can't grow here for the life of me, but it's so fun to see. And of course they're super well adapted, right? And they don't have to water them. In fact, he's making the drainage 10 times better so that he can keep them alive so they're not too wet. And so pretty neat.
So we have maybe, 3, 4 minutes left or so. And there's one little tip. I think it was in sort of an FAQ, a frequently asked question section of the book. And it was talking about like if you wanted some annuals for sort of extra oomph, during the growing season, you could make these little pockets by embedding in the gravel, embedding pieces like 6 or 8 inch pieces of pipe, of clay or metal pipe, down into the gravel and fill those with soil. So in other words, you're not creating a big soil area, you're just planting into these little pipes. And I just sort of loved the idea of it's almost like plugs,
And that crazy gardener would be me because I wanted to add more color to my gravel garden, but planting annuals in that gravel every year was just a kind of a pain. So yeah, I had some old clay pipe that I just use for crazy pots anyway. And so yeah, they were about 8 inches deep, and so I just sort of embedded them in the soil a little bit. The gravel comes up to the top edge, but yet soil is available to them in the top. And so I can plant really drought tolerant things that I'm like, Cleomes,
What do you think? Like,
Cosmos do
yeah, like.
great.
I could maybe do zinnias or something.
Yeah,
Zinnias,
yeah. In fact, I'm growing zinnias this year to put in them. I always do them under lights, this, that, and the other. And then like poppies seed in there. And now I've found, because my gravel garden is right on the street, and all the de-icing snow has sand mixed in with it, that 2 feet along the curb is getting infiltrated with some sand. And so it's kind of fun. I've been throwing California poppy seeds in there, some Verbena venariensis, Corydalis lutea, which is a nice
That's
self-seeder.
fun. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're
Yeah.
all just kind of seeding in there. Now, every once in a while, I get a dandelion in there too. But in the rest of the garden, no, I don't get any of the self-seeding. But so I just kind of rolled with it rather than try to fight that sand, which is would be impossible. So
Right. Right.
it's kind of a fun opportunity then to grow drought tolerant annuals, which I typically wouldn't be able to. So yeah, and a garden like Chanticleer. And Lisa's method is actually mixing sand and some soil in with her gravel. She wants it to self-seed
Yes.
and be an artist and just kind of pick and
Yes.
choose what she wants. But I like the less maintenance
Yes. But
end
that
of
it,
my
right,
life.
because as any of us know who have gravel in an area of our property, a shallow gravel with soil just underneath it, it's the favorite place for everything to self-sow, you know. So,
Exactly.
yeah. Well, the new book is The Gravel Garden: Visionary Drought-Defying Naturalistic Designs. Jeff, it's really great that you did this because we needed to see the diversity of possibilities, you know, I think in one place. I think it's really time because it's a subject that's been coming up. And yet I'd see a little of it here and a little of it there. So this is great. I thank you. And as I said, we'll have a giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And it's good to talk to you again. I hope I'll talk to you soon again. Thank
You
you.
too, Margaret. Thank you very
Okay.
much.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and RobinHoodRadio.com.